That's where I know you from. From the white party. You gave me crabs.
Still, queer as folk. Tonight, Emmett turns into a ruthless pigmaster top. And Michael has dinner with a guy that gave him crabs. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
This episode is called Daddy Dearest, Sunny Boy.
It first aired on Showtime in the U.S. on February 11th, 2001.
It was written by Jason Schaefer, who wrote episode 5, Now Approaching the Line. It was co-written with Jonathan Tollins, who wrote episode 6, The Art of Desperation. It was directed by activist filmmaker John Grayson, his first of 4 Queer as Folk episodes. Grayson's body of work mostly deals with AIDS and gay subjects. In 2009, he courted some controversy when he opposed the Toronto International Film Festival's inclusion of Tel Aviv as a sister city. 4 years later, he was arrested and detained in Egypt for 50 days while en route to Gaza. There's a great article about him on torontolife.com if you want to learn more.
There are a couple of synopses available, one through IMDb and one through Showtime. I'm going to go ahead and just read the one from Showtime because I'm
tired of the fan synopsis.
The fan synopsis, and I feel like it's a little spoilery. So Showtime describes Daddy Dearest Sunny Boy. As Emmett meets a cyberspace friend in person, Michael prepares to meet David's more sophisticated friends at a dinner party. Stuck up is what they were. And Brian wrestles with the choice of whether to give up his parental rights of baby Gus.
This scene starts out with a very interesting shot, I guess we'll call it, of Emmett naked in front of a 2001 computer, complete with a CRT monitor, and he's jacking off. So that storyline kind of goes in a really funny direction. So we'll talk about that all at once a little bit later in the episode. So let's just cut ahead to the scene at Woody's, where we're getting a good description of friends and how friends dislike one another. The central focus of this scene was really about why Dr. David doesn't hang out with any of the guys at Woody's.
It's as if Brian takes great offense to it, that Dr. David Cameron can't be bothered to meet Michael at Woody's if they're going to be meeting up. And it's like, well, we know from our first introduction of Dr. David Cameron when he went to Woody's that one time. He's like, oh, nothing's changed since he was last there. So why would he bother going to the bar?
I did like how the hidden theme there was that all the friends really wanted to hang out with Michael's boyfriend. Or maybe they didn't want to, but they were curious why it didn't happen. I think so far, everybody that Michael had been interested in was part of that scene. He wasn't a hunky chiropractor that cruised him at the big queue and seduced him in his treatment room.
They didn't have a meet cute, you know, during an appointment like he does with Dr. David Cameron being all corrected and whatnot.
Ted had a great line where he said that he doesn't like Michael's friends either, in direct reference to Brian. I love when Ted gets catty.
He takes one look. He takes one look at Brian and is like, "I don't like his friends either." It's those moments when Ted is just snippy enough to let in, and it's just fantastic.
It's great when he finds his balls to be snippy to people versus the way a lot of his lines are, which are schlubbing him up and just making him. Yeah, exactly. So it's a refreshing change of pace when he really, really takes digs at people, especially Brian.
It's like that coma knocked it into him or something. That 20-something minute coma.
Well, Brian did fuck him back to life. Well, he didn't fuck him back to life. He fucked the orderly back to life. Justin, of course, shows up and Brian is catty to him again. That's a recurring theme that we always see where Justin's first entrance has Brian being all snotty towards this boy.
And that we know he will eventually fuck again.
Yeah, sometimes only minutes later.
What are you doing here? I thought it was a school night.
You're here.
I'm a grown-up.
Barely.
Go home.
So that was just sort of a pro forma moment. Everybody exits the bar, and the funny thing is it looked like they had just come out of like a strip mall or something, or like maybe they just closed Chuck E. Cheese for the night and they were walking to the car. And I don't know if you noticed this, Matt, but all of a sudden Ted opens his trunk and he gets something out of the trunk. But I have no idea what that was or why he did that. We never see anything about it again.
It's very Pulp Fiction like. There's the camera from the you know, every time they open up this the briefcase, we just see this gold light. We don't know what it is. It's probably just a MacGuffin. What I'm curious about though is when Justin is in the bar, he like bites something. Was that a condom?
Yeah, he did. Yeah, because
Justin, if you bite into that, it's not going to work.
Yeah, well, in episode one, we saw the sex ed lesson from Justin, and that didn't stop Brian from opening it with his teeth
and just tearing into it. You make a great point though about when they enter the when they exit the bar, it's always really dark.
Yeah, it's like gritty and like dangerous looking, and in, either in an alleyway or like in a big parking lot, like this one was. It's a parking lot of the Big Q, maybe.
Is Liberty Avenue really just adjacent to the Big Q?
It probably had more to do with getting shooting locations for like season one. The budget was probably pretty low, so they would have to find disused locations where they could just block it all off and shoot it without having to disrupt traffic and things like that. Especially outside of Babylon. You know, Babylon is this dingy entrance in an alleyway, and they've always got it sprayed down with water to make it look shiny.
And shiny and sweaty and ugh.
We did just a quick nod to the Emmett storyline. We did find out in this scene that Emmett is pretending to be a top.
Well, he's pretending to be a very beefy, like basically the opposite of how he sees himself, which is he keeps describing what as a Nelly bottom, something like that.
We'll talk about that more. We loved the Emmett storyline here, and we struggled for a while to figure out why it was there or what it was about. So we'll get to that in a little bit. Meanwhile, at the lesbian's house, Gus has a fever and he's throwing up. First time parents, Melanie and Lindsay, freak out and call the doctor.
They're trying to explain all of his symptoms, and you know, it makes it sound like he has the flu, which I mean, for a baby, it's pretty urgent.
Especially with first time parents where they have no idea what why their child is malfunctioning.
He's not a robot. He's a human being, Patrick.
They probably did use a mechanical baby for those scenes. Just saying.
And but you know, the nurse makes a point of like which one of them is the mother, and they're saying they'll raise them together.
Ooh, that catty clerk behind the counter.
There is a nurse or someone who, as soon as she hears that they are raising Gus together, she like shoots up and immediately looks down like she can't be bothered anymore. But Lindsay says that, you know, I was the one who gave birth or something like that.
Squeezed him out.
Yeah. And she goes back, and Lindsay's or Mel is fine with it. She's like, I'm just worried about Gus. Just get him back there.
You could see her starting to boil over a little bit, though.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, she grabs Gus's blanket and tries to explain to the person who has already had a reaction to the news that the two women are raising a child. That, you know, she's like, oh, can I go back there? It's his blanket. I just want to make sure that he's coming. And this woman.
Look. Miss, or whatever you are, I believe it was already explained to you that only the child's parents or legal guardians are permitted to be with him.
Whoa!
That really elevated it right there. She starts out with a look, then she, you know, kind of condescends, and Melanie doesn't hold back.
And Melanie's not one to hold back.
And I believe it needs to be explained to you that I'm the one who loves him and feeds him and walks him and plays with him and changes him and cleans up his shit and wipes up his vomit and pays the bills. And you listen to me. I stay up half the night worrying that he will grow up to be happy and healthy and loved. So don't you dare tell me I have no right to be with him. You vicious homophobic cunt.
A vicious homophobic cunt.
Ow.
Well, and the nurse has the nerve to be, like, offended by it. It's like, well, you were super shitty to her when she's worried about her child. I mean, the speech that Mel has about how she's like, I'm the one who is with him every night when he's waking and crying and worried about him. I mean, it's actually a great moment of power for Mel, and I really liked it.
Well, and then all of a sudden, Brian's there. They apparently called him, summoned him to the hospital, which I'm not sure why they would do that. They had always made a big deal about trying to raise Gus independently of Brian, So there's Brian. Why was he there? Why'd they call him in the first place other than to carry the scene through?
No, like you said, them being first time parents, they call the other legal guardian. You know,
so you think they thought it was something very serious that,
I mean, it's quite possible.
Was about to drop dead.
I don't think that he would drop dead, but I think maybe they still hold out that Brian shares some modicum of care for his son.
I think Gus underacted his illness. Because in the scene back at the house, Gus is just sort of, you know, he's like robotic baby as normal.
It's not specific enough for you is what you're saying.
Yeah, I didn't get the sense that he was near death. They just had to drag Brian into it, but it just didn't make a whole lot of sense to me. He's just there all of a sudden.
Well, and I'm...
aligned with Melanie, which was refreshing to see.
Right, because he was seen through the homophobic bullshit.
He saw that he and Melanie were on the same side.
At this time, it's not about their pettiness towards each other. It's about making sure that Gus is taken care of, and they're going to shut down any homophobia that comes their way.
Yeah, we're lucky that Brian didn't drive a Jeep
through the emergency room. Yeah.
So I did a little bit of research on this and found out that when this was shot in 2000 and airing in 2001, hospitals were perfectly within their rights to do exactly what we saw in this episode. It wasn't until 10 years later that Barack Obama gave a directive to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services to form new regulations that would require any hospital receiving federal funding, which is almost all of them, to grant equal visitation rights to all families, not just biological families. That took 10 years after this episode before it hit the federal level.
It's mind-boggling to me that it's literally only been now, what, 7 years
There's a lot of cases where LGBTQ families are blocked by hospitals for that. It's something that in the community we still need to be aware of and be vigilant for. This scene illustrated that 17 years ago, something that can still happen today, especially with the current political climate that we find ourselves in 2017.
The dumpster fire we find ourselves in.
Yeah. The beginning of the scene where the attendant's asking for the adoption papers. Yeah, is that the thing that a family really needs to be concerned about when they're taking their dying robotic son, to the hospital?
Let's undercut the drama of the scene by mentioning that Gus is clearly robotic.
This is a comedy show, so our show's comedy. This was a drama scene. Not too many people have the kit ready to go with all the paperwork that they need.
Right. I mean, that's up there with just asking any brown person if they have their papers with them to see if they're legal. It's insane.
This scene was very useful, I think. And I wonder if people watch it now, if they really understand the differences between then and now, and also the need to still be vigilant.
But while we're worrying about Gus at the hospital, Dr. David Cameron and Michael are relaxing in Dr. David Cameron's beautiful home.
Architecturally perfect mid-century modern.
At first, I thought we were just back at the cabin. I thought they went back to the woods.
Why did you think that?
I don't know. It was just so huge and nice. I was just like, oh, they must be back in the...
Yeah, the big fireplace made out of river stone and all of his furniture that was perfectly matched. Exactly what you'd think the chiropractor would be living in.
Exactly. Because remember, he lives comfortably.
He was biting Michael in that scene, though.
I can't help it. I see you. I just want to take a bite.
Don't you love it when they get aggressive?
Playfully. But we also have an underwear check, Patrick.
Oh, yes. Michael is wearing cute little dark blue trunks. They were pulled up a bit high. They went all the way over the top of Michael's bubble butt and at least a couple of inches up. They were high water undies.
I will say, I feel like a lot of the pant wear in this show.
Pant wear.
Let's go with that. Because it's not just the underwear. It's also the
pant wear.
The ill-fitting khakis that I believe Michael wears.
Yeah.
Tend to ride high as well.
Ted's khakis run a little high too. And I think Ted's are pleated and Michael wears non-pleated. So that's our menswear discussion for this episode.
That's the men's fashion section of the podcast.
So Michael notices some pictures of people.
Who are these people?
Let me see.
People in the picture, they look nice. They look straight.
That's Laura and Steve. This is on New Year's Eve. Steve's a urologist. Laura works at Pitt. They're really good friends of mine.
So how come I've never met them?
Oh, I don't know. You want to meet them?
I don't know. You want me to meet them?
He starts to ask why he's never met any of these people and whether he's Dr. David's little secret. And as soon as he said that, I was like, you know what? He is. Dr. David has him all but locked in the basement.
No, disagree. Yes. No, he is not locked away
he's
in the basement.
He's a fiend.
How long has this relationship been going on at this point? Are
this
we on their fifth date?
Fifth date that we've seen. I think we're led to believe that they've been together for much longer and they've experienced more time together,
okay.
I think.
That's fine. I don't think he's hiding him away because he points out who these people are. Like, he's very forthcoming with the information. This is so-and-so. This is so-and-so. I've known them for such and such years. And then Michael asks the questions, why haven't I met them? And he says, oh, do you want to meet them? And next thing you know, we have a dinner evening planned. So I don't think
took him a while to do that, though, because well, Dr. David was all about setting up the stage for you're my partner. You're my boyfriend. Why wouldn't he have already hosted these events to introduce Michael? Michael's coming out party to David's friends.
I just don't think it's that big of a deal. I mean, sure, you meet your partner's friends after a certain amount of time.
I'm starting to dislike Dr. David.
Well, you can dislike him all you want because I think it's Michael that ultimately fucks up this relationship. I don't think it's that big of a deal. And the only reason why it's being brought up now is because in Woody's, this was brought up by, of course, Brian. Oh, maybe he doesn't want you to meet his friends. And it's because Brian keeps inserting these little seeds of doubt in Michael. Mm.
Yeah, you're right.
And it drives me up the wall. He is the one. It is always Brian that is adding the doubt to Michael about this relationship, about what Dr. David Cameron wants with him. You want Michael to be smarter.
to see
through this.
Meanwhile, speaking of Brian, there's another scene going on at Brian's loft where we see Justin on the phone with his mother. He's doing his homework when Brian comes home.
Yeah. Just remember, again, Justin is 17 and still in high school.
Everybody has homework to do, right? So Justin's talking to his mother and the conversation surrounds Justin coming home and Justin's playing strong in front of Brian. And then he gets off the phone after, you know, we see Brian reacting to what Justin's saying. After he hangs up, you can see that Justin's choked up about it. So he's really in a state of mixed feelings about being with Brian, who has become his end-all be-all, and then also the ties back to his family. And Brian has this line where he says,
"You know, it's really not worth crying about."
And I hated that line. Because it is, no matter why.
And it's a weird masculine thing that Brian is trying to play off for Justin, because then Justin says, I'm not crying, it's just allergies.
Yeah.
It's like, no, it's okay for you to be upset because you're 17 years old, living with a much older man because your father assaulted him.
Yeah, and gave him the ultimatum.
And then kicked you out.
Right.
So yeah, you have every right to be upset.
Yeah, and I think Brian's attitude doesn't really come into full view until later in this episode. This was a little bit of a setup for something that's going to happen in a bit. But meanwhile, let's go to the gym.
Let's go to the gym. And there were a lot of crotch shots in this moment. A lot of, because they're all working their legs. They're all on, you know, legs. You should never skip leg day. But this in particular, I mean, this was like tight, close up.
Loved it.
Of course you did.
Great Patrick. Cinematography. Well shot. We also get another funny hat from Emmett.
I don't know what that hat was like. Samuel L. Jackson and Jackie Brown, like circa 1997.
It was a Kangol hat. I was like, and he just had it on backwards.
I was like, what is this?
Yeah, I love his costume.
What are these hat choices that the costume designer has come up with for Emmett?
Because they're awesome.
Right now they're on their third strike.
Well, he's a little bit of raver still. And I like the subtle nods from the costumers to keep Emmett firmly in the drug-taking club kid look, even though they're at the social gym.
The very social gym.
So Michael starts talking about his upcoming dinner with Dr. David's friends. once again, we've talked about this in past episodes. Michael is portrayed as a total barbarian who cannot be trusted at table.
It's like he can't handle social situations that are not at Babylon.
Or his mother's house or the diner.
He should be studied by like sociologists with how terribly he seems to be able to handle this.
But they give him no credit for even thinking that he might be able to roll with it and be able to be okay with it and not stress out. It's something that a lot of people would be nervous about, but for me, I think I'd be excited about it. It's something new, something I haven't done before, and I would rise to the challenge and maybe have some butterflies, but not to the level that Michael is having his breakdown over it.
It's always nerve-wracking when you're going to meet your partner's friends or your boyfriend's friends, you know, because there's going to be a shorthand that you're not privy to.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Shorthand.
But they are still people and you're having a dinner.
Right.
Relax.
Especially, you've got home court advantage too, because you're in Dr. David's architecturally perfect mid-century modern home. So
perfect home.
That
perfect
does come man. Into play though. And I'm going to talk about that home court advantage in a little bit when we get to the actual dinner. But first, a lesbian interlude. They have to talk to Brian about Gus. This was purposeful because after what they went through at the hospital, they realized that the only option that they had available to them at the time was to have Brian waive his parental rights and give the lesbians the ability to make decisions on their own.
Which I think they lay out the reasoning very clearly. And given what was available to people at the time, it makes total sense for them to ask this because we saw in earlier episodes that Brian does not want to be wholly involved in Gus's life.
Yeah, he has this on again, off again interest in it.
It's as if it's only interesting for him to be a part of Gus's life when it conveniences him.
Yeah, it's sort of like one of those things that you like the idea of, and then when it actually comes down to doing it or doing the work for it, it becomes less and less appealing.
Right.
And so I think he likes the title of it. I think he likes having that on his resume. When it comes down to actually performing some of the things that he's padded his resume with, he comes up short. And that's a theme that we see over and over again with Brian because of his ego.
When Lindsay and Mel propose this arrangement to Brian, Justin is there.
Yeah.
And Justin is like, how dare you? You can't do that. He's Gus's dad. And I'm going to be like, child, you have no say here.
Well, what was Justin doing there? I'm just curious how that played out, because earlier in the show, we see that Brian is being catty towards him. Then he's doing his homework and he's kind of catty again. They're sharing anecdotes about their fathers. Well, let's go to Mel and Lindsay's house next. So it just seemed a little strange that he would be there for what was going to be a very deep conversation with the lesbians. If the lesbians are smart, they would have said, this has to be a serious conversation. We need to talk to you alone, not bring your teenage lover with you. And it became even more obvious when Lindsay tries to bait Justin out of the room with ice cream.
Because remember, he's a child.
Justin, would you like some ice cream?
No, I'm okay. What?
But Justin was the one making incredibly valid points in it, even though they were opposing what Melanie and Lindsay were thinking, and even Brian was thinking at the time. So Brian, at that moment, was in favor of it. He was going to do it. And I guess Justin kind of talked him out of it.
Well, no, at the time, he says, I want to teach Gus one thing. You can't rely on your old man.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, that's a harsh, harsh thing. And of course, a piece of the Brian Kenny puzzle that we are privy to later on in the episode.
I did like that Justin had a very unique position in that conversation because he had recently distanced himself from his own father. So it was useful that he had that perspective, but it also didn't make him very impartial.
Especially that being a decision that he made. You know, he was given the ultimatum, but he made the decision to say, I'm not coming home and I'm not going to follow the rules that you're laying out in order for me to stay here.
So it's about time that we go to Brian's loft to see a My Fair Lady scene with Michael, where they are teaching the barbarian to be a lady.
I mean, this was kind of wonderful.
They even called out Pickering.
They have an entire dinner setting in front of Michael, and Emmett is trying to lead it. And something I really loved about this was Justin's chiming in.
Oh, he was so good in that.
While playing a Game Boy.
Yeah.
He
didn't even notice that.
He wasn't even looking up from the Game Boy, but he knew it. So clearly, because he also goes to, you know, rich private school, has had elocution lessons. and he loved to sort of flaunt it in front of Michael, because every time he tried to every time he corrected Michael, Michael had this look of, how dare you? Like, it just kept getting his cord. It was great.
Well, what do I talk about?
Movies are always a safe bet if you want to appear current without sounding controversial.
And Justin was like all of a sudden the smartest person in the room. He knew it all. And it was great. I loved that scene. And once again, Michael is the person who's never left the house.
You would think he's never even seen a plate.
Now, where's the bread plate?
On your left.
And the funny thing is, all Michael had to do was have this conversation with David. And they could have rehearsed this in the comfort of the architecturally perfect mid-century modern house.
But just remember that Michael just does not have the ability to plan that out. So he goes to his friends that he thinks he can trust. And they
Which is significant. He goes to his friends before he goes to his boyfriend or man friend or whatever we want
whatever
to call
they
that
want to
older
call
man.
His man Friday.
We might as well go to Babylon now. So this was just a pretty quick scene. Emmett's doing his praise Jesus dance there, which was awesome. We'll talk about that in a little bit. The only thing I wanted to mention about this Babylon scene is, mysteriously, it was hula hoop night at Babylon. Everybody had a hula hoop.
They have very interesting themes at Babylon.
But enough Babylon. Let's go to dinner at your dreamy Dr. David's architecturally perfect mid-century modern house.
This dinner party. Wow. Now, I understand it can be a little intimidating because, again, these are Dr. David Cameron's friends who have a different background and living style than Michael. They are academics. Wow. And I do love that Dr. David Cameron built up Michael saying, yes, he works at the Big Q, but he's a manager at the Big Q. And I like, he is standing by his man, and I really appreciate that.
So what is it that you do, Michael?
I'm in retail.
Really? Where?
The Big Q.
He just got a promotion. He's a manager.
The Big Q. Eddie, isn't that what people call you?
I've seen those stores, but I've never actually been in one.
They sell everything you can imagine.
But nothing you'd want to buy.
But there is that gay couple, specifically the one who was like, he had the multiple piercings in his ear.
Javier was his name.
It was fabulous.
He was a snobby little fucker.
Yeah.
Because you mentioned the Big Q, and he's like, oh, I would never shop there. I was like, do you get a nosebleed having your nose up that high all the time?
Dr. Laura, the PhD in economics, is the one that completely annoyed me. She's the one that was canoodling almost with Dr. David Cameron when the bell rings and it's Michael. First of all, Michael doesn't ring the doorbell there. He's got a key. He should let himself in, right? Why is he knocking on the door?
Does he have a key? He has a key?
Surely he does.
You're making an assumption that he has a key.
Okay, let's say he doesn't have the key. Dr. David knew he was coming over. Why wouldn't he leave the door unlocked for him?
I would say he was being respectful. So good for Michael. Yeah. He proved that he has some sense of respect, which is great.
You're a Dr. David denier.
No, I am not. But Dr. Laura did not annoy me because
I hated her.
She opened her arms to Michael and saying, like, I've known Dr. David Cameron for a while.
At last, the boyfriend.
I'm sorry I'm late.
Nonsense, you're fashionable. I'm Laura. Listen, I've known David forever, so if there's anything you need to know about him.
I hate that when meeting somebody's friends for the first time. I hate that one overly aggressive person, the know-it-all, that comes prancing up, like steals the thunder away from Dr. David and just needs to own the entire experience in the... It's just... I hate it. It's like, look, you might know everything about me from your chiropractor friend who you're the fruit fly to, but...
We have struck a nerve with Patrick.
But allow me to present myself to you myself. Don't make me feel uncomfortable for just being there. That's why I didn't like Dr. Laura, PhD in economics. Dislike.
Okay, well,
see her again, though.
So I am not. I am not a fan of Javier. Was it who was incredibly snobbish the entire time? Like, and this is at a table full of academics too. So, and I love that Michael was trying to figure out how he knew him.
Yeah, do you think was he trolling him, or did you think that he really, really didn't remember this guy? At first I thought it was fake. I thought that he was just making something up. Well,
Michael is being very honest, I think is the best way to put it.
No filter.
Absolutely no filter, because he brings up his uncle Vic, who went to Italy to die because he had AIDS. Yeah. And you're like, oh, that's wonderful after dinner conversation.
Mentions diarrhea at the table before the shellfish paella.
That's exactly the image you want before shellfish paella.
Which was the only thing that reminded Michael that he apparently...
He knew Javier.
Got crabs from Javier at... A white party?
That's where I know you from. From the white party. You gave me crabs.
Yes, at a white party. And
that, like, immediately dated the series. The white party.
White parties still happen.
But as Javier would say, it has everything you'd want, but nothing you would want to buy.
What a stuck up. I
hated Dr. Laura.
I hated Javier. The white party. There we go. We each found one.
I thought Javier was useful in that he was funny. And
no, he was a prick. He was not funny. I did not find a damn thing he said funny. I thought he was incredibly rude to Michael, who is...
I could relate to him.
Also realize that Michael is co-hosting this dinner with Dr. David Cameron.
Not really. Michael was almost a prop.
He states during his My Fair Lady session that he is like the co-host.
If he was, why was he late? He was the last person there. He should have been... The first person there greeting the guests.
I didn't say that he passed his sessions as My Fair Lady. But yeah,
for him. I'm all worked up over this dinner.
This dinner party was so infuriating. But to then throw it in, like, I know how I know you. You gave me crabs. I think that stops the dinner party in its tracks.
I wish there would have been more to it after that, because that storyline could have gone in a lot of different directions, but instead
just lays there.
It just ends. Yeah. And there was this nice little piece of physical acting as Javier and his boyfriend are leaving Dr. David Cameron's architecturally perfect mid-century modern house, where you could see that it was a thing. It was nice that it was subtle. It was nice that they didn't, no pun intended, make a meal out of it. But I wish there would have been more, because this was a funny story. And even as much as I was complaining about Michael having to be taught how to behave at table, I liked this scene. And Michael's complaining afterwards that I don't even know which fork to use. It's like, so what? It's when you're in your boyfriend's house and you're having an impromptu dinner like that, nobody cares and nobody's judging you.
Who gives a shit? Seriously.
Let's talk about some lesbian sex now. I'm all worked up over that dinner party. Well,
okay, this lesbian sex scene, like rewatching it, I'm like, I know that
this was pornographic.
This was very, very graphic.
Yes.
Because, I mean, first of all, it's Mel completely naked, mm-hmm. head to toe. And then when they have their sex scene, it is...
Do you remember that earlier?
Nothing is really left to the imagination here.
Yes. That's for sure. Do you remember that earlier episode where Lindsay was breastfeeding Gus and Melanie, yes, like grabs the teat. And
the very clinical term, yes. Yeah.
And we see that she's really, really got a fetish for it, and she really liked it. This came back in this scene. Well, and then Melanie starts to get like rough, and she's like dragging her around.
Oh my God. Horrified. She's like, for lack of a better term, she's like getting in there. But I find it really interesting that it's the women that we are seeing fully naked in a series that primarily follows the gay male. Yeah. And this is my problem with the series as a whole is, you know, why, maybe because it is 2000 and, you know, since then we've had shows like Looking that are a little more unabashed in showing male sexuality in its fullness.
Looking did have a straight scene in it, as I recall. But you're right. It was male focused.
It was male focused, and you know, this is a show that I think is definitely more male focused. But yet we're seeing the women fully naked, like fully. So I think it comes down to the period where even in a show that follows a gay male, we're dealing with an over sexualization of women.
I think the nicest part about this scene was the song that was playing, and I didn't enjoy this scene much, so I didn't bother going to the Netflix version. You're a gay male. True. But it was Shannon McNally, Down and Dirty was the name of the song, and it really fit the scene. So just wanted to comment on that. That was really the only note that I wrote about this, other than gratuitous nudity, Melanie still loves Lindsay's breasts, then it turns into pornography, Melanie gets rough, here's the music credit. That's all I wrote on it. I'm sorry.
I mean, and that's fine.
Can we just take a shower with Brian and Justin now?
Was he helping him with his homework?
His Spanish homework. Which all of a sudden, like, Brian speaks Spanish also. I think it was Spanish.
Was it Spanish? As someone who's Mexican, I was listening to it thinking it was not Spanish, but maybe I wasn't paying that much attention.
Do you think Justin's studying Italian or?
Maybe that's what, because it was one of those things that I'm watching this thinking, you're helping a high schooler with his homework while he's taking a shower in your apartment.
And his father just disowned him.
Right. I feel a little weird.
But it worked because it was really highlighting the differences between Justin and Brian. It was very, very obvious in this scene. Justin's father just disowned him. Brian disowned his own father. Now Brian is disowning Gus while Justin objects. The scene was really, really well directed, and the script was very good for it.
It's also a moment that really shows that there is, as much as they deny it, a relationship that is happening here.
Yeah.
Brian could easily shut it down by saying, don't come to bed or get out or something like that. But no, it's like they're having a conversation, and their relationship allows them to have that more open and freeing opposition.
There was a good visual also at the end where Brian is probably about 6 inches taller than Justin. And there was these two shots that Grayson kept going to that showed visually man and child. I liked it, and I thought it was something that was either on accident or on purpose. And I eventually netted out that it was on purpose, because most directors would have had Justin standing on a crate to get them eye to eye in the scene. But I believe that he deliberately left Justin lower. And so it had many different characteristics to it, the superior, the inferior, the man, the teenager. It was very good visually.
And then we go on to another bar, but this is a bar we have not been to.
This looked more like a bowling alley than anything else. It's exactly where you'd expect to find Brian's father, whom we've so far only heard a little bit of ogre-ish types of descriptions of him.
Right, and here we are meeting Brian's father for the first time.
Jack Kinney.
Sounds very like a typical, kind of sounds like he's a typical drunk.
Yeah. Well, they're playing cards when Brian walks into the scene, right, which is what you expect. They're probably playing poker, actually.
Right. So, okay. So I think we've also established that he's a gambler. And
drinker, gambler, gay basher.
All great qualities so far.
But did you see how friendly he was when Brian first walked in? He was happy to see him.
Right. Well, yeah, that's the thing is that
Clearly
there, Brian is living a double life when it comes to his father, because his father makes comments about women to Brian, and basically being a ladies' man. So again, mm-hmm. Brian is not out to his father.
He certainly looked out. He's got a black leather jacket on and a white V-neck tee.
He gives his father an envelope that is obviously filled with money.
Yeah. And so let's break this down a little bit. Mm-hmm. We don't know why Brian went there, do we? He just showed up, and he had an envelope of money. So that envelope of money looked something right. like pre-ATM.
Right.
He's just got this
clearly envelope. There's either it's bad writing, this is a behavior that is almost like scheduled. Mm. Like he knows he has to go and deliver this money to him at this time.
That's interesting.
Because he knows that he's going to ask. And because his father says, like, I am documenting every penny that you give me, and I'm going to pay every penny of it back, which I'm sure he says that every time he gets money from Brian. And it's probably a load of shit.
There must have been more to this particular scene, and it got cut out because it left a lot to the imagination, which I tend to like in Queer as Folk episodes, because so often the writing is just terrible. And I like when there's some work that we have to do as viewers to understand it and to form our own opinion.
Given the full story with Brian. Mm-hmm. We're continually just given pieces of the puzzle, and this introduction of his father and the way he interacts with him, that's a major piece of the puzzle.
Sometimes, goddammit, I look in a mirror and I say, Jed Kinney, a dumb son of a bitch, should never have been a family man.
Which is an awful thing to say to your child. You're all but saying that you wish your child had never been born. Exactly. And it's... Jack the Drunk kind of didn't entirely mean it that way, but the undercurrent was, yeah, he really did mean it that way. They start doing shots together, and Brian doesn't hold back at that point. He had heard enough, and he's ready to just get lit.
In which he does.
And of course, somehow finds his way to Michael's house.
He's wasted, and Michael can clearly tell that he has been with his father.
Yeah, that was interesting too. Michael had seen this before, so he's aware of what happens. So maybe that plays into what you're saying, where this is like a scheduled thing, where once a month Brian goes sees his dad,
and this is how he ends up.
Yeah,
I think that's a very likely case.
It was cute the way that Michael was suddenly taking care of Brian. Everybody has had to deal with a drunk friend before and put them to bed. Hal Sparks acted this very well. He was so believable in it. Sometimes in the gay scenes, straight Hal Sparks doesn't entirely come across as convincing. This one he did. There was even an underwear check here.
Okay.
Brian had on loose-fitting white trunks. They weren't cute. They were bad.
Loose-fitting? Ooh.
Yeah, they were all stretched out. So right. I didn't like those at all. But anyway.
But and the scene ends with, you know,
they get in bed together.
They get in bed together. And it's because we've heard how much Brian has taken care of Michael, you know, particularly in the episode where.
Do we ever see that, though?
Well, I mean, we're given very obvious hints to it, especially in the episode where Debbie has her episode and can't work, and Brian is very quick to offer money or to help, and Michael points out that, you know, he's always there to fight the bullies or give money, you know, he takes care of him in ways that we're obviously not seeing all the time. But here we finally see a moment for Michael to take care of Brian, and Brian is showing himself to be emotionally vulnerable. Which is very fascinating.
I saw the part where Brian starts crying, and I don't know, the whole scene kind of didn't work for me. This was a little bit of Brian's ego disappearing, which I don't know is that we wanted to see that. I don't know is that we wanted to see this impotent Brian. We are so accustomed to seeing powerful Brian, and seeing Michael in control, it just wasn't, something just wasn't clicking for me in this scene. I just don't think that it's plausible that Brian once a month gets this upset over kicking money up to his dad.
I think this scene, though, lays the groundwork for events that follow, particularly for Michael and actions that lead to Dr. David Cameron. So maybe in this context, when you look at it on its own, yeah, it's difficult to understand why it was working, but it does assist what happens later on in the next episode.
Yeah, maybe the way that the show was written, they wrote the entire season. You know, they wrote the outline and the arcs for it and need to fill in the blanks. And maybe that's why I found it a little bit weak and unbelievable, because oftentimes the writers, when they know what's going to happen next, they're not writing in the moment. They're writing more of a long game than a short tactical gain for their characters. So the next day, we find ourselves at the signing ceremony at the lesbian's house. So
yes, Brian, remember, Brian has said that he will give away his parental rights.
He's just saw his dad last night, had his nervous breakdown with Michael over it. Then he rejects it.
On one hand, you can tell that this experience that he's had the night before has lit that fire that, oh, he doesn't want to be his father.
Right.
Which is to say that he wants to be a part of Gus's life.
Yeah, so I guess our last scene where Michael is putting the crying Brian to bed was purposefully driving this scene to the conclusion where he's really not going to sign over his parental rights. It was an interesting scene in that Melanie didn't explode over it. Normally she's the one that just freaks out. She was upset. She didn't like it, but she didn't go crazy over it. I wanted to see another Melanie explosion here.
It's almost like she's drained. That's what it reads to me, is that she has been put through so much because of Brian.
So much, really?
I think
hasn't been
so.
That much.
Well,
this kid is like 6 months old.
Well, no, it goes beyond Gus, though. Like, yeah. She's made it very clear she never wanted Brian to be the father. She never wanted him to be involved. She never, and it's like she's continually blocked at every turn. And at some point, you're like, can you have so many explosions?
Right. He kind of beat her down.
Exactly.
Eventually, so that done. Brian still maintains his parental rights for Gus. Melanie's out in the cold. Lindsay is still the birth mother. Time to go to the gym.
This gym is more like a coffee shop than a gym.
Dr. David comes in fully clothed.
Yeah, he just shows up.
Is he a member at that gym? Why would he be a member at the gay gym?
I would think at his beautiful mid-century home, you might have some equipment there anyway. And Dr. David Cameron gives Michael like a smoothie and they need to have a talk outside.
Yeah, let's step out onto this gothic balcony outside the gym.
What is this gym?
This gym's on like the 50th floor in Pittsburgh.
I don't understand where this gym is. I don't understand this gym's location. It's very odd.
It's really nice though. I'd go to that gym.
Well, and then, bombshell, Dr. David Cameron asks Michael to move in with him.
And first, Michael thought that he was about to get dumped over his bad performance at dinner.
I mean, right. But the thing is, at that dinner, right after that dinner, Dr. David Cameron found it hilarious. Like, he wasn't deterred by it in any way, but Michael was mortified. And because Michael is one of the most neurotic characters this side of Ted.
Michael left after that dinner, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
Yeah, so this must have been the first time that they came back together afterwards, after the aborted dinner. So I like that tension where we really don't know what's going to go on there. And the episode ends with Dr. David saying, I want you to move in with me. And then the version that we watched had a campy 80s song by Robert Palmer, Bad Case of Loving You, which starts out, Doctor, Doctor, give me the news.
What's over? I want you to move in with me.
Doctor, Doctor, give me the news. I got a...
It's really on the nose, isn't it?
It has a little kind of crowbarred into it. It's like, let's do a lyric search and find what songs involve doctor and news.
And love. And something that we have not touched on, but is evident in the entire episode, is this is the first time we get a storyline involving Emmett at the forefront that carries throughout the entire episode. And it's...
weird.
It's an interesting one, I think, is how I'm going to say it. So we know at the beginning of this episode, Emmett is yanking it hard. to some internet chat room.
Very hot scene. I can only imagine how hot it would be.
I believe the names in the chat room were Pitts 9x6 and Use My Hole 27.
Come here, you.
Step up, Patrick. And
did you notice that after Emmett blew his load, his little washcloth cleanup was very minor?
Yes, and he seemed exhausted after that.
Yeah.
Like, he was panting and like, but
you at least have to be wiping your face off or your shoulders after that one. But
no, he was just little devil to you. And what was so fascinating about this is that he then has the personification of his screen name.
Yeah.
Basically the version that he has created of himself. And what we've noticed is Use My Hole 27 wants to meet him and hook up in real life. And he hits escape on that chat room very quickly.
Yeah, this arc just kind of took the show to a different level. It was like a supernatural type of thing.
Yeah, it's like he's seeing this other aspect of his personality or
I liked it.
What he desires. So Pitts 9x6, who proves that he is 9x6 and uncut and 4% body fat.
You can take that one.
That's a lot to take.
I meant, yeah, I've got to use my whole 27. You can have Pitts 9x6.
Great. Okay.
Now that that's out of the way, I liked where this story was going, but it seemed like weirdly out of place because it was all these intercuts of the Emmett story amongst everything else. So it was almost like comic relief, but it was cute and it was funny and it had some good themes to it, but it was just all over the place.
Right. Because we're seeing this, we're seeing Pitts 9x6 appear.
At yours.
You know, he's at the gym, he's at Babylon, trying to teach Emmett how to be a more aggressive, quote unquote, masculine version of himself.
I think it was a little bit of a story of two angels, you know, one on the left shoulder, one on the right shoulder. And the evil angel was the one that was pushing Emmett to be more himself and to be a little more conscience free and to let himself go. It was all the fictitious characters were what are stereotypically gay male idolized people.
Yes, because so as the climax of this particular storyline for Emmett is building, he basically goes into, I guess you want to call it, the pornscape. and he's taken into the chat room and we see all these stereotypical like images of the idealized male.
Yeah, all the perfect bodies, the perfect looking people.
Trying to like make a connection in these chat rooms, and he comes across Use My Hole 27, and his persona convinces him to meet Use My Hole 27. And when they do in fact meet, it was actually really quite great.
You're the most ruthless pig master I've ever talked to.
Then what the fuck are you doing standing in front of me, huh? Drop to your knees, pussy boy.
Emmett gets nasty. It's kind of great. And his persona encourages him to take control. And so Emmett kind of unleashes this real asshole.
Yeah, he became what he was pretending to be.
Yeah, online. And Use My Hole 27 goes, yes, master, and gets right on his knees. And what's so great is that after this moment happens, which I also noticed they did not close the door.
Well, that's because I can't remember what his name was. The other guy, the imaginary guy was outside the door coaching him. Oh. Wait, that was Pitts.
That was Pitts
9x6. Yeah, Pitts 9x6. He was outside coaching him.
Emmett comes into Babylon for the hula hoop night with his shirt unbuttoned and sunglasses on.
Fabulous.
Like, you would think his balls were just hanging low, and he's like, he is the most macho. Like, and he comes in with a swagger, that then encourages Ted to try and talk to one of the guys in the hula hoop that he's been looking at for like 3 hours. And Emmett's like, it's easy. Just go and talk to him.
Did you see Ted get tangled up in the hula hoop guy on the way down the stairs?
That's exactly, that's the problem.
So this curious storyline, I tried to sum up into what the hell was going on. So first I put myself into the time frame. So this was 2001. Techno dating was just starting to get real. So chat rooms, Manhunt, sites like that were just starting to come around. Before that, it was mostly a text-based world. Now you can have pictures and stuff like that. The theme, I think, was kind of pornography addiction or detachment from the real world or trying to tell a cautionary tale of fantasy and fake profiles. And I like that part about the fake profiles because that's 100% relevant now. You get fake profiles, you get that Emmett experience where you're talking to somebody, they're portraying themselves as one thing, and then if they show up, they can be something entirely different. So this was some good foreshadowing to what was going to come next. I thought it was a very curious way to present it in 2001. It was almost like, let's play on the you've got mail moment and just try to make the show relevant at the time. In the end, when you look back at it 17 years later, you're kind of thinking, well, gee, wasn't that nostalgic? But at the time, it was really interesting to see something like that. Because in 2001, not everybody had an internet connection unless you're still at university. Or if you were one of those people that had your parents buy you a computer, not even a laptop, a computer. it wasn't in your pocket is the point. And a lot of people would stay home versus going out to see things in the real world. Now you can do both. You can take your computer with you and go out into the real world and re-engage on a hookup if the first one didn't pan out the way that you wanted it to. So lots of commonality in this storyline that's still relevant now.
Yeah, I want to expand on that. I think it's very much this episode was about the fantasy versus the reality.
Mm-hmm.
Here we have, I mean, it's very on the nose with Emmett's storyline when his fantasy comes to life.
Yeah.
But then there's also the fantasy that I think Michael has about his relationship with Dr. David Cameron. And then when reality sets in that he feels out of his element and out of his league, there's the fantasy that we have of who Brian is as an individual when then we're hit with the reality of what his relationship is with his father and how that actually breaks him. And the same thing goes with Mel and Lindsay, that there's this fantasy of this is what their life should be. They are the loving parents to baby Gus, and then they're hit with the harsh reality of bureaucracy and bigotry. So I think to expand on your idea with the pornography, when looking at the whole episode, we're looking at a fantasy versus reality.
Yeah, very good eye. That's something that I didn't connect together. I think I was focused directly on the what is this crazy cyberpunk thing.
You were focused on use my whole 27.
That too. So let's wrap this up and ask our usual question of, does this episode hold up 17 years later? For me, yes and no. The hospital visitation part is mostly in the past, but still something that occurs from time to time. So as a community, we need to stay on top of that one. And this was a good reminder of it. Dr. David's dinner party absolutely still happens to this day, even if it was overplayed by Michael being the barbarian at the table. Mixing people with different backgrounds, I think, is always a good experience, though. So that definitely holds up. Emmett's storyline about online addiction, as I was just talking about, is 100% still relevant. It seems like nearly every gay relationship these days starts out on an app. And there's almost always some exaggeration and showmanship involved in it right at the beginning. You're either going to get through that right away if you hook up within the first 10 minutes, or if you keep talking to somebody and get to know them. So that part definitely held up for me.
I'm going to break my streak of no's and say that this episode really does hold up. As you mentioned, the scene in the hospital really rings true to the fights that we are still having in terms of full equal rights. While we have definitely made large strides, there are still feelings of roadblocks at every turn, and we have to continually, there's no chance for us to relax. We also have, I think you're spot on in terms of the cyber obsession that we have. While it is of an older technology in the episode, to know that we have multiple apps that are all doing the same thing for us, that, you know, I see friends who will see people that they've been talking to through these apps, and rather than going up to them in person, they will go back to the app to have a conversation. It's like as if they don't have the ability anymore to have a human connection. And then there's also the ability to share in a relationship, I think is a huge thing in this, especially with Michael and Dr. David Cameron's storyline. Like, he should be able to interact with his friends and not feel intimidated, even if they are in a different intellectual field, as it were. But Michael seems hell-bent on showing his inferior ability to do so.
So that's season one, episode 9, Daddy Dearest, Sunny Boy. Next time we'll be talking about episode 10, Queens of the Road. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
Thanks for listening. Leave a like, share with a friend, and subscribe so you don't miss our next episode. Still, Queer as Folk was written and performed by Patrick Randall and Matt Dominguez. Made with love in Chicago.
Hey, Todd, how's it going?
Fine.